climate change, as you may know, we're doing absolutely nothing. Nowhere in the world is anything positive going on to slow climate change. Nothing. Zero. Even the plans are pure crap. In other words, nobody's doing anything. CO2 is increasing. Methane, which is a more powerful greenhouse gas, looks like it's going to get worse much faster than we expected because of the heating of the permafrost and so on.
That's Paul Ehrlich, our feature speaker this week on Radio EcoShock. Welcome. I'm Alex Smith.
Because people don't know what's important. We're having a presidential debate in which biodiversity hasn't been mentioned. Possibly, and I'm delighted to see what you're doing here, but possibly the loss of biodiversity is the single most threatening thing that's happening to us among a whole array of threatening things. And yet we've had a presidential debate now for almost 4 years. Hasn't been mentioned.
His 1968 book, The Population Bomb, awoke the world to the ecological and social threats behind exploding human population. Since then, Paul Ehrlich and his wife Anne have published dozens of books, many of them pioneering in fields like biology, evolution, and social affairs. His latest with Anne is The Dominant Animal and the Fate of Biodiversity. I was privileged to hear and record Paul Ehrlich speaking to a packed house at the University of British Columbia. All around Paul were priceless fossils and displays of now extinct species, just part of the collection awaiting the opening of the new Beattie Museum at UBC in Vancouver. In this speech, Ehrlich is hardly the ivory tower academic. He ranges over the multiple threats now facing humanity and the world species, not to mention the commercial and political insanity now rocking his own country, the United States. A warrior academic this week on Radio EcoShock. You get the whole speech as I heard it on September 24th, 2008.
It is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Paul Ehrlich, Bing Professor of Population Studies at Stanford University. So sit tight for a gripping lecture. From a right-wing neoconservative's perspective, you likely would never hear anyone as infamous as Dr. Paul Ehrlich. And they say that when you're making people mad, you must be doing something right. From that perspective, Paul is doing lots right. Seriously, though, it doesn't take a neocon infamy to show that Paul is doing lots right. He's more decorated than a grizzled army general, although much meaner. He's written more books than many people have read. And he's had a greater influence on public discourse and policy than just about any academic I've ever met. In terms of decoration, Paul has won dozens of major awards, including the John Muir Award of the Sierra Club, the Gold Medal Award of World Wildlife Fund International, a MacArthur Fellowship, the Crawford Prize of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, which is given in lieu of the Nobel Prize in fields where the Nobel is not given, the Volvo Environment Prize, and many more. And if I don't cut these lists short, then I'd take up all of Paul's time just with his many acclaims. His books make a splash. Most famous so far is The Population Bomb, which has its own Wikipedia page, a clear tug of war between neocons and environmentalists. Throughout his career, Paul's contributions have ranged from fundamental, rigorous population biology to social and political critique. In 2004, Paul published On the Wings of Checker Spots, a Model System for Population Biology with Ilka Hansky, and also One with Nineveh, Politics, Consumption, and the Human Future, with his wife, Anne. His most recent book is The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment, and that should be in the UBC bookstore and also, of course, online. Paul's influence on public discourse and policy is immense and also somewhat intangible. The Population Bomb changed the way that the world thinks about population issues. It's critiqued for projections, actually based on UN population scenarios, that many say are well off. I actually don't think they're so far off, and those that are off partly, probably, because the book had a much greater influence on international and national policies than Dr. Ehrlich might have imagined. With this hugely influential book, Paul contributed to the turning of the tide that was the human demographic shift, the great slowing down of human population growth in the last four decades, for which people everywhere should be thankful. Dr. Ehrlich founded the field of coevolution. He raised the specter of human overpopulation. And he's here to talk to you today about biodiversity and the dominant animal. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Paul Ehrlich.
Thanks, Guy.
How's the sound?
Yeah.
Can everybody hear? Okay, if not, start screaming. If you think I'm red-eyed, you're right. I burst the blood vessel in my eye listening to George Bush describe you shouldn't knock neocons because they've all turned into socialists. You know, they spent the last 20 or 30 years trying to remove all regulation on financial instruments in the United States, and they pressured some people that I know. For instance, you got to remember that in this mess, there are a lot of poor people who really got screwed. They were sold mortgages they couldn't possibly afford because they didn't understand the conditions and so on. They take these dodgy mortgages and put them together, a whole bunch of lousy debt, into packages which they then are transformed into structured investment vehicles and sold around and so on. And all of a sudden, the whole mess goes down the drain, and the people who, besides the people who've been screwed, the people who are the neocons are losing money. And so what do? They want a $700 billion bailout, not from you guys, but it'll catch up with you too, from the citizens of the United States, from the very victim. So I'm a little bit annoyed. But I did come up here to relax. I was hoping to get an airplane. I'm a pilot and go out and gun down some wolves. But Kai was not able to arrange that for me. So what I'm going to do is give a lecture instead. And I'm going to restrict myself so we can have some time for discussion to 2.5 hours. Talk about the state of the world, and it's going to be a mixed bag. It's delightful, actually, for me to be back in Canada. Canada is my third home. My second is Australia. But back before most of you were born, I worked for the Department of Agriculture and Defense Research Board in the Arctic. I spent 3 summers in the far north, and it was a transforming experience in my life. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I find most impressive about the world, I'll come back to saying probably some things about cultural evolution later on, but one of the things that did for me was let me recognize what I call the culture gap, because in 1952, when I was living with the Inuit, I thought I told you people I was going to walk around. Do you want me to actually stop and talk into that? It was an incredible experience, but one of the things in retrospect that I thought about is that every member of the Inuit group essentially had in their possession all the cultural information, all the non-genetic information of the group. The men knew what a woman's white knife was for and how to use it if they needed it. The women could actually go out and harpoon a seal through the ice. That wasn't their normal chore, but they knew there were no mysteries in it. And that's basically the way our ancestors were for almost the entire history of Homo sapiens. That is, everybody possessed the non-genetic information of their group, their culture. Look at us. There's not a person. Collectively, we don't have 1/1,000,000th of the genetic information of our culture. All of us in this room, everybody who's educated. After all, how many people? There's probably somebody here that could do this. I certainly could. If somebody put a pile of complete set of computer parts in front of me, I couldn't begin to put together the computer. I certainly couldn't explain it to anybody. There's more cultural information in a 747 than genetic information in our genomes. And so everybody only has this tiny little bit of the cultural information of our society. One of the ways that this book got written was that Ann and I have been distressed by the fact that you can get all the way through Stanford University and I suspect UBC without having a clue about how the world works. I'll bet you that at least half of your faculty cannot tell you the difference between climate disruption and the ozone problem or describe why people should be concerned. But certainly at Stanford, it would be 90%. I'm being really nice to UBC. You can get all the way through Stanford thinking that your food comes from supermarkets. We had a faculty member in computer science that thought that milk was manufactured. It's no small surprise that you get idiots like George Bush in high places, because people don't know what's important. We're having a presidential debate in which biodiversity hasn't been mentioned. Possibly, and I'm delighted to see what you're doing here, but possibly the loss of biodiversity is the single most threatening thing that's happening to us among a whole array of threatening things. And yet we've had a presidential debate now for almost 4 years. Hasn't been mentioned. Climate change has barely been mentioned. It's only mentioned on the websites. It's not mentioned in the debates. What's really important in the United States today, the critical issue facing society, is should gay people be allowed to get married? Yeah. My answer is yes. Why shouldn't they suffer like the rest of us? I mean, I don't see why there should be some special dispensation. And so why did we call the book The Dominant Animal? Well, I don't think I have to convince this audience that Homo sapiens has been brilliant and risen to dominate the planet. And the domination is present all over the place. I mean, we have laced the planet with railroads, roads, our airplanes fly everywhere. We've now probably built on 3% of the land surface. We farm another 12% roughly. We graze our animals on about another 25%. About another 30% is in forests that are exploited to one degree or another, and the remaining 30% is either under ice or in high mountains or extreme deserts where, curiously enough, there's very little biodiversity for us to threaten. But we are, of course, threatening biodiversity as we take over the planet. We now mobilize minerals more rapidly in most cases than natural processes of erosion. We now probably either take or divert or some way co-opt about 50% of the net primary productivity of the planet. That's basically the food supply for everything but green plants and some microorganisms. We've done it. I mean, we have gotten to the top. We are clearly in control, although I notice we named it the dominant animal because it's not at all clear, as Josh Lederberg pointed out many years ago, that we'll survive, that some virus won't come along and just take us all out. And in fact, lots of the things we're doing is encouraging that kind of denouement. So denouement. I have to tell you that the best quote I heard from George Bush on this trip, somebody told me on an airplane, is, do you realize the French don't even have a word for entrepreneur? What can I tell you? You got to keep your sense of humor in this world. Otherwise, there's no hope at all. So we've taken over the planet, but the paradox of dominance is we don't seem to be able to stop taking over. In other words, we're now undermining our life support systems. And, of course, the other organisms of the planet could best be described as the working parts of our life support systems. And as we take over more and more of the planet, co-opt more and more of the NPP, pave over more, farm more, and so on, we are beating up biodiversity at a level that I think makes it very clear, and if I forget to come back to this, somebody could ask me, you know, people now say we should call this the Anthropocene, the new geological epoch, and I think that's correct. But it's also we are already well into the sixth extinction, and the basic reason is that although we have not started losing species in terms of the total number that were lost at the time of at the KT boundary when the dinosaurs bit the dust, populations are being lost at an incredible rate, which is both clobbering our ecosystem services and, of course, eventually will lead to higher levels of species extinction. So if anybody says, why should UBC be concerned about biodiversity, it's the same thing as saying, why should UBC be concerned about the continuation of our civilization? The two are just so tightly. If you ever hear a politician say, we should concentrate on the economy and not the ecology, you know for sure you're listening to a moron, because the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the ecological systems of the planet. So here we are, we're dominant, and we are doing all sorts of things to shorten our tenure in that position. And let me run over... I sometimes call that the paradox of dominance. We've gotten to the top, we're Homo sapiens, and instead of doing something intelligent and building ourselves a sustainable society, we're wrecking our life support systems. And the best way to, I think about our wrecking of the life support systems is just to go back to the old heuristic IPAD equation. The impact that a society has on its life support systems is a product of three basic things. One is the number of people in it. Second is the level of consumption of each person, which we call affluence because I pick it is harder to say than I pat. And T is a catch-all for the technologies and social, political, and economic systems we use to supply the consumption. And the good news, and the main good news in this story, and it's not all that really good, is on the population factor. That is, in the 40 years since the population bomb was written, we've really learned how to get birth rates down. And not only that, it turns out the very best way is to give women education, opportunities to control their reproduction, job opportunities, and so on, and you get a very dramatic drop in birth rates, particularly sometimes we did a study in Costa Rica about why, when they did all those things for women, the birth rate dropped to the total fertility rate, the average family size is about 3, and then it leveled out. And it should be, you know, you want it to be somewhere around Italy, about 1.8. You want the 0.8s and the 0.5 so that you do have a supply of George Bushes if you need them. But and it turned out that what they'd done all those things for the women, but they've forgotten that men play a role in this, I'm told. I think it was mostly physicians that were doing the work, and they don't know where babies come from anyway. And when they refocused some of their attention onto the men, the TFR kept going down. And as you probably know, in Europe, many countries are either starting to shrink or on the verge of shrinking their populations. Exactly one of the places you want it to happen, because, of course, their impact on the planet is gigantic compared to, say, Bangladesh's, because they're such high consumers. Somebody want to guess what the most overpopulated nation in the world is? You have, sadly, a citizen of it standing in front of you. See, normally when I travel outside the United States for the last 8 years, I've claimed to be Canadian, because it's just too damn embarrassing. I was talking to Swedish and Norwegian government officials last week, and they're all looking at me saying, can you explain to me? And so, anyway, the U.S. is not only now the third most populous nation with 303+ million people in it, which makes just we're only behind India and China. But, of course, when you factor in our consumption, our impact is huge. We use about 25% of the world's resources, something on the order of, you know, 5 or 6% of the world's people. But the projection is that we're going to go from 303 million to 439 million by 2050. Canada's got about 33 million, is going to go, I think, to about 42, which is a very substantial increase for a rich country, but nowhere near as substantial as the U.S. And no one has ever come up with even a semi-sane reason for having more than 140 million people alive in the United States, and we're scheduled to go to 439 and continue growing beyond that. The projections go to infinity, although I think the mathematicians of the audience will think that's probably unlikely. Anyway, that's the cheery story, because if current trends continue, the UN thinks that population growth in the world will level off somewhere around 9 billion people. Which, we only got 6.7. Now we're only going to add another 2.3 or 2.4 billion people, which is only about 400 million more than were alive when I was born. In other words, when I was born, there were 2 billion people on the planet. We're now at 6.7, going to 9. And what most people don't know is that if we have those additional people added, they're going to have a much higher impact on the life support systems than the last 2.3 or 2.4 million people, so a billion people. You know why? Because we're brilliant. We're Homo sapiens. Linnaeus named us the bright man, you know, the brilliant man. So guess what? People did not start farming the marginal land first and gradually move towards the river bottoms where they had rich soils. They didn't start drilling down 2 miles for oil and then slowly work their way to Pennsylvania where you can get oil by sticking a pointed stick in the ground. They didn't go to the places where water was really short and spend a lot of money to desalinate or depollute the water and then move to the rich river valleys. So, of course, I'm being ironic, I hope. So every person you add requires much more energy proportionally than the last person, because you've got to go to poorer resources, more distant resources, farm lousier land, use more fertilizer, on and on and on. So that's one of the bad things about the population story. And the second one is nobody has a clue whether or not we can possibly support even 6.7 billion people for much longer. In other words, if you've had Michael Clare here and he's talked about resource wars, we've been talking about resource wars for a long time. The first one was the 67 war in between the Arabs and the Israelis. What was it over? Does anybody remember? Water. And as a matter of fact, the only place I've ever considered an optimist is when I talk to earth sciences departments where people study water problems, because water is going to be a gigantic problem and probably the source of many more resource wars. Fortunately, though, this is gin, not water. I don't want to rust my pipes. And, of course, we have our now failed resource war where we went and tried to grab the Iraqis' oil. By the way, there are still a few people who don't seem to understand that there never has been any teeny-weeny question about why we invaded Iraq. It never had anything to do with weapons of mass destruction or any of that crap. It's always been over oil. Even Greenspan said after his... the best quote on this comes from my colleague one of Sal, your famous faculty member here, Sally Otto, who is a contribution to UBC, you owe us a lot, from Stanford. Her graduate student colleague, Gretchen Daly, said before the war, she said, do you really think we'd be invading Iraq if their major export were broccoli? You see, we have a government where nobody knows any history. The whole Middle East was designed around oil. If you want to blame somebody, you got to blame Churchill for switching his battleships when he was Lord of the Admiralty to running on oil, because oil has many advantages for running battleships over coal, not the least of which is, if you're towards the end of your cruise when you get into a battle, on a coal-fired battleship, you have to have almost all your men shoveling coal from the more distant bunkers to the boilers. Whereas, guess what? On an oil-powered battleship, you just turn a valve, and there it is. Anyway, so we're having resource wars already. It's not at all clear that and the epidemiological situation, which we may talk about a little bit in the third hour, if I get there, are going to let us get to 9 billion. But if we get to 9 billion, of course, it will only be possible to have that as a point where we start sliding down towards an eventual sustainable population. We know we're overpopulated right now by the simplest of all criteria, and that is we can't live on our income from our natural capital. We're forced to destroy our natural capital. Our deep, rich agricultural soils, our fossil water from the last ice age that's in aquifers, and biodiversity, the most important of all, we're getting rid of all of it, and yet we depend on it. So we have to somehow get back to a level where we're able to live on our income from our capital, not just on our capital. So the population situation is the cheeriest of the situations. The consumption factor is much more difficult to deal with. I say on the population side, we know what to do. The reason we're not doing it is mostly political inaction, but it's not that we don't know how to do it. Literacy rates in women are still way below men, essentially, around the world. The treatment of women is bad in virtually every country. For instance, when Anne and I went to China about 15 to 20 years ago to talk to women about the one-child family policy, which abuses were much talked about by the neocons. It was actually the Chinese who announced the abuses and tried to do something about it. And in fact, one of our colleagues has had a lot to do with working with Chinese demographers on these issues. But they arranged at that time for us to have, I was at CBS correspondent, at NBC correspondent at the time, and they arranged for a quiet meeting with about 20 very well-educated Chinese women, and Anne and I wanted to hear their views on the one-child family. Took 2 minutes. Every single woman said, absolutely had to do it, right policy, we're totally behind it. And then one of the women said, I'm a great neurosurgeon. I will never be head of the team because I'm not a man. And then somebody else get in and said, I'm the best person they have in my firm, but I can never be president. I can be vice president because of my gender. In other words, a lot of these countries sort of advertise how, the same thing, by the way, in Norway and Sweden, which you think of as very equitable countries, women don't get a break around this planet. They do a lot better than they used to, but gender and color differences, which are nonsensical on a biological basis, is hopefully all though, are still major things. Whether or not Obama wins will probably be controlled more by his skin color than the fact that he's three times as smart as his opponent. That's the way it goes. That's a biological fact. If I went through the evolutionary part of the text, I would have given you some details on that. The reason is very clear, again, from an evolutionary context of why we became sight animals, why we were small group animals that focused very much on things that sight bring to you, like skin color or shape or hair length or whatever. If we were smell animals, we'd have a very different world, believe me. Anyway, so the population may or may not be good. The consumption situation is grim for a lot of reasons. One is that most economists and most politicians think that the cure to every economic problem is go out and buy another SUV or refrigerator. The idea that you have to keep economic growth going. There are a lot of ideas about why we have that. The main one is that with growth, you can fool the poor people into thinking they'll eventually get rich. It doesn't happen, but the trickle-down theories, therefore we have more people hungry today than there were people when I was born. But the trickle-down ideas are very big and therefore keep the whole economy growing. But it's worse than that because the economists who are beginning to wise up to this and look at it, some of the best economists in the world, have not yet done the work to decide how you would control consumption. It's very easy at one level for the rich to say, yeah, if the choice is, does anybody here got $30 million in their pocket just by chance? U.S., not Canadian. Well, you have a choice. You can go out and buy an executive jet or a Van Gogh. And it's clear from the environmental point of view, the Van Gogh is a better example. But as you move down the scale, of course, it's more difficult to figure out what are wise choices and how to control them. It's not simple like the population size thing, but it gets even worse than that because, of course, there are probably a billion people and maybe 2 billion who should be consuming more if they're going to have decent lives and be able to contribute to society and so on. So the consumption problem is really hairy. And when you put the two of them together, of course, what do you get? You get the various things that are driving us down the drain. The one, when people think about environmental problems, and I give you an example. We had in 2004, we had a press conference at the National Press Club, and the issue was to try and bring environmental issues to the table for the election because nothing was going on, just like this time. Every single question, every one, was about climate change. Not one touched on climate change's impacts on biodiversity, which is one of the critical things about it. Matter of fact, there are a number of things deadly wrong with this current situation with climate change. First of all, let me say, I think it's a horrendous threat. It may be the biggest threat humanity faces, but it may not. There are a whole series of other things I'll talk about that may end up being worse. Second of all, if you talk to the average person about what they're worried about climate change, it's whether or not their beachfront home is going to be soaked by sea level rise. Now, sea level rise is the one thing that's close to certain with climate change because, of course, even if we didn't have glaciers to melt, water expands when it gets warmer. The main direction of climate change or climate disruption is what we now are trying to keep calling it because it's not just warming sounds too cozy. The water will expand. Sea level will rise. But I can almost promise you here that you'll be able to outwalk the rise. It's not going to be something that's going to dramatically affect your lives. Think about it. We've probably already entrained close to 1,000 years of continual change in precipitation patterns, the precipitation patterns upon which our ability to feed even 6.7 billion people, many of them not well, utterly depends. We're melting, for instance, the so-called Himalayan water tower, which is all the glaciers of the Himalayas, and which provide the continual flow of the rivers of South Asia, is disappearing. Same thing in Peru. Lima's water supply is disappearing because the glaciers are melting. And remember, it's not just how much rain falls and flows to the sea, it's the pattern of flow. You know, if you had all winter here rain and then no rain in the summer, you'd have a tough time with your rain-fed agriculture because the water would all go out to sea when you can't use it and not be around. But not only is about 1.3 billion people are dependent for their water on the Himalayan water tower, and the very same areas we have the rice and wheat is growing within a degree or two of the maximum temperature at which they can produce. And guess what? Everybody know the CIGAR group here, the Consultative Group International.